puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago. Yes, it's time for our weekly edition of Abandoned Manitoba. And I'm very excited about this one because Gordon tells me that he thought about me as he was writing this. So I'm very intrigued. Gordon, good morning.
Good morning, Nadja.
Now, remind us before we go ahead what the hint was from last week and then why you were thinking about me as you were writing this.
Well, I hinted that we would be talking about a little private grain elevator near Brunkild with a sign inside it that was written in Japanese. And that sign revealed something about the interesting way in which the building had been built. And essentially, the story was that it's about a rather shameful aspect of Canadian history, specifically the discrimination against immigrants.
So I'm still trying to fit in where I fit into grain elevators and Japanese and discrimination?
Well, because you are an immigrant, as we all are. In fact, if you go back far enough, all of us are immigrants. And yet, people through history have intentionally or otherwise identified people by differences, you know, differences in their ethnicity, their skin color, their eye shape, the way they worship, the things they believe, you know, and it's often leads to shameful treatment of people different from ourselves.
Well, it's a topic that's still so relevant even today.
Indeed it is, unfortunately.
Now, how does that work into what we're talking about today?
Well, of course, through Manitoba's history, we have seen the arrivals of all kinds of immigrant groups, and they have each, to some degree, suffered discrimination, you know, starting with the Icelanders who came in the 1800s, the German-speaking Mennonites, of course, the fact that they were speaking a different language than the majority. We have, of course, the Hutterites who were, in addition to speaking German after the First World War, they also lived communally, which was, of course, different. But I think probably the most conspicuous immigrants are the ones that may have suffered the most because, of course, they were visibly different. Perhaps the Asians have suffered more so than many of the other groups that have arrived here.
They really did face especially harsh treatment.
I think so. Racist treatment of Asians goes way back. You know, if you think about, for example, the building of the Canadian Pacific Railway, a lot of the work, the backbreaking labor that was done to build the CPR was done by people from Asia. You know, they began arriving in the 1880s, and very quickly people began to realize, you know, these people are very different. We don't want them here. And so they instituted what was called a head tax, so that every man, for example, who came from China had to pay $50 to enter the country. And the tax was increased. By 1900, it was $100. By 1903, it was $500. The whole intention, of course, was to dissuade people from coming to Canada. It made it nearly impossible for these men coming from China to bring their wives, to bring their children, to bring their parents. Well, in fact, between 1924, when a new act of parliament basically excluded them, from 1924 to 1946, do you know how many immigrants from China came to Canada?
No idea.
8.
Wow.
Yeah. So
it was effective, clearly.
Very effective. Mm-hmm. In fact, that act wasn't repealed until 1947, and the remaining restrictions were not lifted completely until 1967. And there are monuments to remind us of this hateful period in Brandon and in Winnipeg, this head tax, and a reminder that we have often discriminated against people of Asian ancestry.
Yeah, regrettable to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. What happened during the Second World War?
Well, of course, one of the things that happened was that the American base at Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese, and that led to a lot of resentment about people of Japanese ancestry. So here in Canada, for example, in 1942, Canadian officials introduced absolutely draconian measures intended to prevent, I guess what we would call today, domestic terrorism. By Japanese Canadians. And in fact, many of these Japanese Canadians that fell subject to this new legislation really had been born in Canada. They were Canadians, just like you and me. And unfortunately, they were seen suspiciously. So 22,000 of them were evacuated from British Columbia. They were mostly in the western part of Canada, and they were relocated out of their homes, their businesses, to eastern parts of Canada, including here in Manitoba.
How many do we know?
I haven't been able to find accurate statistics on it. I'd love if somebody could point out how many people came. But I know that a lot of them came here to help in agriculture, mainly because this was, of course, the Second World War. A lot of the able-bodied men were overseas in military forces. And so a lot of the farmers in Manitoba needed help on their farms to plant, to tend, to harvest their crops, especially ones who grew sugar beets. You know, we've talked about sugar beet growing in Manitoba before, a very labor-intensive farm. And so bringing people here who could then be put to work hoeing the sugar beet crops was seen as a real big plus.
What do we know about the farm where they worked?
Well, the one group that we're talking about here specifically came to a little farm just outside of Brunkild in the rural municipality of McDonald, not far from Winnipeg. And the farm itself was established in 1931 by a 39-year-old fellow named Ernest Hoffman. Now, I'd like to think that Mr. Hoffman was particularly responsive to the plight of these Canadians in that he himself was an immigrant. He had actually come here from Russia. Now, he came at the age of 2 months, so it's debatable how much he really remembered about his Russian home. Yeah. He came here, though, from some other country, and eventually he married a woman who was herself the child of Austrian immigrants. And so, you know, they, of anyone, should probably have appreciated that these poor people were being discriminated against because they were immigrants.
What sort of work do the Japanese internees do?
Well, they arrived with a variety of skills. And of course, because these people were from all walks of life in British Columbia, many of them came with skills that probably wouldn't be also suitable on a farm. So, for example, the group that came to the Hoffman farm, there were some of them that were tailors. Well, I can't imagine there was a big demand for that skill, but a lot of them were very useful. So there was one group, for example, that were knowledgeable in horticulture, of course, growing crops. That's a very useful skill. There was one fellow, apparently a Mr. Shudo, who was an expert at poultry and, of course, chickens, for example. And so he was able to develop a very large flock of laying hens for the Hoffmans, and they developed a hatchery business where they'd raise little baby chicks so that they could sell to other farmers that wanted to establish a flock of chickens. But I think the significant part from the standpoint of our story today is that there was a master carpenter among these people who came, a fellow named Mr. Tsuchiya. He was put to work building a large structure to store grain. But more importantly, to take that grain, they had a grist mill inside that where they could grind the grain into flour. And then they could use that, of course, for baking. They could sell the flour to their neighbors. They developed a business where they could produce livestock feed for the other surrounding neighbors. You know, these people really did help the Hoffmans to grow their farm. And so I found, for example, an aerial photo of the Hoffman farm from those days, and it became a very prosperous farm. It had a number of large buildings. And say this building, this mill and grain elevator, was sort of central to their operation. It was built by these Japanese Canadians. And I think they were treated kindly because inside was this sign, and it had Mr. Hoffman's initials. But maybe more importantly, it had a Japanese symbol that said prosperity. You know, and what it said basically was that they wished Mr. Hoffman prosperity. You know, and if it was somebody you hated, you know, you wouldn't do that. So I think what I take from that is that despite the fact there was this hostility in Canada as a whole, that I think the Hoffmans didn't have that attitude. And in fact, what I learned was that after the people were able to return home to British Columbia, many of them stayed in touch with the Hoffmans. In fact, they would routinely get in touch. So that's something you don't do if it's somebody you dislike. So I like to think that this was a nice, rare example where these Canadians were treated kindly and not as potential domestic terrorists.
What happened to the mill?
Well, there's an interesting story. So last week I hinted on the air about this building. And shortly afterwards, I was contacted by its owner.
And, no way!
Yeah, and in fact, the part two was that his name was Bruce Lawden, of course, who we are familiar with here at CBC.
Not to be confused with Bruce Layden.
So he contacted me and said, you know, I own that building that you're going to talk about next week. Would you like to see it? And I went, oh, of course I do.
Yeah.
You know, and so earlier this week, I went out there. He had gone to considerable lengths to allow me to see inside. He'd taken the boards off of the windows and doors so I could see inside. He put up ladders inside so we could climb up and see the machinery. You know, I was able to climb near the top. And I have to say, I'm not a great person for heights. So I was a little bit apprehensive, but it was good because we got great pictures inside to see the master carpentry. I mean, it was fine carpentry, this tongue and groove that was used on the boards, on the floors to hold them together, the wooden chutes to redirect the grain from one compartment to another. Clearly, this had been built by a real master carpenter, and so that was neat. You know, and they've in the years since then, they have modified it. They, for example, took out some of the machinery. They took out the leg that used to elevate the grain to the top. Mm-hmm. They filled the pit where the grain would first collect. They filled it with concrete. They've cut through some of the walls and floors to allow grain to fill much of the space. In fact, for quite a number of years, Mr. Lawton told me, they used it as a granary. They didn't use it as a mill at all. But the mill machinery, some of it is still up there near the top, and I was able to see it. So that was just so exciting that I could see that. Unfortunately, the sign that I was really hoping to see, that sign that said prosperity, a number of years ago, the Hoffmans, who had since moved away, contacted Mr. Lawton's father, and Mr. Lawton's father gave them the sign that said prosperity. So I'd like to think somewhere out there, that sign saying prosperity is still proudly displayed by the members of the Hoffman family.
I love that one of our listeners happened to own one of the abandoned Manitoba sites that you're talking about. Our listeners.
And of course, my hint wasn't so obscure that he didn't recognize it.
Well, speaking of hints, we're doing something different next week. Of course, it's Remembrance Day next Sunday. And so we have a very special edition of Abandoned Manitoba. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, well, you know, I thought we really need to talk about the 100th anniversary of the ending of the First World War. And the Manitoba Historical Society, with whom I volunteer, has been working on a project for a number of years to map historic places around the province. So one of the aspects of that project has been to map the war memorials around the province. You know, and I get their precise location. I take photographs of them. But of course, on the sides of many of these monuments are names of the people from the various communities where these monuments stand, of the people who served and died in the wars. And unfortunately, at the beginning, they were simply names. But we've been able to reconstruct, in a lot of cases, these people. And that's who, of course, they are. They're living, breathing people who went overseas and didn't come home. And so we're going to talk next week about that.
And you've got a special guest that you're going to bring with
you. Yes, indeed. A friend of mine, Daryl Taves from Morden, who has done a yeoman service at reconstructing these names, their biographies. He's going to come and join us and talk about the trouble he's had in trying to reconstruct a lot of these lists of names.
I'm really looking forward to that one. So, Gordon, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Nadja.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.